Have you ever stopped to think that something as simple as a family handshake could actually have the same legal weight as, like, a super formal legal document?
Interesting.
Well, that's exactly what we're diving into today. We're taking a look at a case from way back in 1825, French versus French, a New Hampshire case that really digs into this whole idea of where family intentions and the strict world of property law kind of bump into each other.
You know what's really fascinating to me about this case? It's how this seemingly straightforward family issue, you know, about land, it ends up uncovering some really fundamental tensions within property law itself, tensions that are still relevant for us even today.
Absolutely. I mean, when you boil it down, it's essentially a legal battle between a father and son over a life estate, and it all stems from a deed that, let's just say, it wasn't exactly legally perfect. And we've got some great resources to help us unpack this. We've got insights from a podcast that's specifically designed for law students, and we've also got a couple of case briefs to work with, one that's really detailed and then a standard one. So today, we're on a mission. We really want to help you understand how courts navigate that tricky space between the very specific legal formalities that are required for property transfers and what family members actually intend to do.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, right. We're going to focus specifically on the doctrine of the covenant to stand seized. Now, I know that might sound like something straight out of a dusty old legal history book.
It kind of does.
It does, but trust me, this case has some really useful lessons for anyone who's interested in modern legal practice and how property law has evolved over time. So, let's get into it. What makes this 19th century family feud worth revisiting, even after all these years?
Well, I think if we zoom out a bit and look at the bigger picture, this case really highlights this constant balancing act that we see in law. On the one hand, you've got the need for very clear, predictable rules, especially when we're talking about something as important as property ownership. But then on the other hand, you have this desire to achieve fair outcomes, outcomes that actually reflect what the people involved wanted to happen. French v. French is a perfect example of a court trying to find that sweet spot, that balance between those two competing ideas.
It's a tough job, right? Yeah. To try to balance those two.
Very.
Okay, so let's get down to the nitty-gritty. What exactly happened in this case? What were the main events that led to this legal showdown?
Right. So the basic facts are these: Andrew French, he transferred his farm over to his son, George. And then after that, George tried to give a life estate in that same property back to his father, Andrew. And it seems like this kind of arrangement, it was pretty common back then, a way for older parents to pass on their land to the next generation, but still make sure they had somewhere to live, you know, and support in their later years.
It makes sense. It's a practical solution for families, right?
It is.
So where did things go wrong? What was the hiccup that turned this into a legal battle?
Well, here's where it gets interesting. The deed that George used, the one he tried to use to create this life estate for his dad, it had some, let's say, significant legal problems. Mm-hmm. Our sources tell us it didn't have the right number of witnesses that were required under New Hampshire law at the time. And on top of that, it didn't really meet all the traditional common law requirements that were usually needed to create a valid freehold interest, like a life estate, you know, all the little details.
So the paperwork was a bit messy. That's what triggered the lawsuit, right? And Andrew basically arguing, hey, even though there are these errors, this life estate should still be legally recognized. But on what grounds? What legal argument could he possibly make with such a flawed deed?
That's the key question here. The whole legal fight revolved around this pretty old legal concept called the covenant to stand seized. The court had to figure out whether they could consider this imperfect deed valid purely because of the family relationship, the fact that Andrew and George were father and son.
Okay, now I think it would be really helpful for our listeners if we could just break down this term, covenant to stand seized. What does it actually mean? Mm. Can you paint a clear picture of what this legal idea is all about?
Sure. Think of it like, think of it as this old tool that we had in property law. It's basically an agreement where someone who owns land promises to hold on to that land for the benefit of someone else. And what sets it apart from a typical sale is the traditional requirement for consideration. In a regular sale, you usually need money or something of monetary value to change hands, right?
Right, right.
But with a covenant to stand seized, the consideration could actually be the fact that there's a close family relationship, like being blood relatives or being married.
Yeah. So their father-son relationship could actually serve as the legal justification for this flawed deed, specifically under this unique doctrine.
Interesting. Now, the court, with Justice Greek writing the majority opinion, ended up siding with Andrew, upholding the life estate. What was the core of their reasoning? What were their main arguments?
Just as Greek and the majority of the court, they took what you might call a more intention-focused approach. Mm-hmm. They really wanted to figure out what the parties intended to do. And their reasoning, as we see in our sources, was based on a few key points. First, the court really emphasized that legal documents, whenever possible, should be interpreted in a way that gives them a beneficial effect. There's this famous quote from Justice Greek where he says, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he essentially says, we shouldn't assume that parties go through all these legal ceremonies for no reason.
Right, right.
They believe the father and son clearly intended for this to have a real legal outcome. Secondly, the court found that the family relationship itself, that father-son bond, that was enough to count as valuable consideration to support this type of covenant. And finally, they brought in the statute of uses, which was still a part of New Hampshire law back then, something they inherited from English common law.
The statute of uses. That sounds like something you'd find at a legal history museum.
Yeah.
How did this centuries-old law end up playing a role in an 1825 New Hampshire case about a faulty deed?
Well, that's what's so fascinating here. The statute of uses basically acted like this legal mechanism to change one type of ownership into another. So imagine you have a situation where someone holds the use or benefit of land for someone else that's more of an equitable concept, right? The statute of uses comes in and says, nope, we're automatically transforming that equitable use into actual legal ownership. Boom. So in French versus French, if the court could establish that there was a valid covenant to stand seized based on the family relationship, then the statute of uses would come into play and execute that use. It would turn Andrew's intended benefit of the land, you know, what he was supposed to get, into a legally recognized life estate. It bridges that gap between who benefits and who actually owns the property according to the law.
It's like this old law was a magic wand, transforming the family's intention, which was backed up by their relationship, into a real property right, that the law recognized all this despite the messed up paperwork. It's amazing.
Yeah.
But our sources also mentioned that Chief Justice Richardson had a concurring opinion. Did he disagree with using the statute of uses in this way?
Chief Justice Richardson didn't actually disagree with the final outcome. He also thought that Andrew should have the life estate. However, he did offer a slightly different way to get there. His concurring opinion said that the transfer could be upheld just by applying the regular principles of common law construction without needing the statute of uses to do the heavy lifting. It's interesting because it shows that while the court agreed on the result, they had slightly different legal paths in mind to reach that conclusion. It highlights how flexible the legal framework was back then when it came to honoring what the parties clearly wanted. So basically, Richardson was saying, look, even if we don't rely on that specific old doctrine, the existing legal principles we already have can still recognize the father's right to the life estate.
It's fascinating how different legal reasoning can lead to the same judgment, isn't it?
Mm.
So the defective deed was ultimately validated because of their family connection, and they used this somewhat archaic legal concept to make it happen. But what does this all mean for a law student today? Can we take away from this that family deals get a free pass when it comes to legal formalities? Like, can we just skip all the detailed paperwork?
That's such an important point to understand. We absolutely should not see French versus French as a green light to just start drafting sloppy legal documents, even if it's a deal between family members. Legal scholars who have analyzed this case, they really emphasize that it's a very narrow exception, a kind of safety net for very specific situations. It's not the norm.
Right. So what are those specific situations? How can we tell when this might apply?
The key, as our podcast source points out, is this three-part test. First, there has to be a genuine family relationship, either blood or marriage. Second, there needs to be a clear intention to benefit the person who's receiving the property interest. And third, the legal document itself, even if it has some flaws, it still has to be written in a way that allows for this beneficial interpretation. There has to be something there that the court can work with.
So it's not enough to simply say, hey, I want this land to go to my sister. There still needs to be some kind of written document, however imperfect, that shows that intention and that fits within the legal framework.
Exactly. You can't just have a verbal agreement, you know, over dinner. Modern legal practice, and rightfully so, really stresses how important it is to have carefully drafted documents to avoid these kinds of disputes from happening in the first place. But studying French versus French gives us this valuable historical perspective on how courts have, in certain cases, been willing to look beyond the strict formal requirements when it's really obvious what the family intended to do. It shows us this ongoing push and pull in the law between sticking rigidly to the rules and trying to achieve fairness based on the unique circumstances of a case, especially within close family relationships.
So there's always that tension between the letter of the law and the spirit of the law.
Interesting. Okay, so for those of us who are studying for law school exams, what's the absolute key takeaway from French v. French? What's the one thing we should make sure we remember?
I think our law student podcast source summarized it perfectly. You have to remember this chain of legal reasoning. Defective deed. Then we look to see if there's a covenant to stand seized, but only if there's a family relationship with clear intent. Then, if that exists, the statute of uses comes in to execute it. And finally, that results in a valid life estate. It's a classic example of how courts can use these equitable principles and historical legal doctrines to make sure that little technical errors don't end up undermining what a family clearly wanted and expected to happen.
That's a great way to sum it up. That's going to be really helpful for people to remember. So we've taken a deep dive into this really fascinating case where family ties combined with this somewhat ancient legal doctrine ended up saving a flawed property transfer. But, you know, property law has changed so much since 1825. And thinking about how important intent was in French versus French, it really makes you wonder, how would modern courts handle similar situations today? Especially when we consider things like digital assets or other types of property that weren't around back then, you know, those less traditional forms of property that families might want to transfer. Would that fundamental principle of respecting and honoring family arrangements, would that still matter, even as the very definition of property keeps evolving in the 21st century?
That's a good question.
It really is something to think about, isn't it?
It is. It definitely is.
Thanks for exploring this with me. Until next time.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure.